Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Well, howdy doody, everybody. And if any of you are there at the top of the hour, thank you for coming back and joining us, because we had a technical glitch, but it appears to be corrected, and I am so grateful. I would like to tell you that my guest today is Emily Earhart. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Hi, Marcia. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And I want to just tell all of you out there in Radio Land, this is one generous, wonderful woman, and I am delighted to have her on my show today. She is the Southern California Regional Development Leader for the Adult Congenital Heart Association. And we're going to be talking a lot about that and the other things that Emily has done in her life, including the fact that we are both Rotarians here in the Westchester community, two different clubs, but the same cause. So shout out to our Rotarians. What I thought we could do right now, Emily, is why don't we let our listeners get to know a little bit about you. Why don't you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was born and raised in Pasadena, so I'm an L.A. native. After high school, I went to UC Berkeley, where I studied anthropology and development studies. While I was in college, I got really into food and was working in a few restaurants and decided after graduation to enroll in the Le Cordon Bleu baking and pastry program in Pasadena. I did that and spent several years thereafter working in the hospitality industry, including at the Ritz-Carlton, and then opening up, had an incredible opportunity to open up a restaurant with my family in Pasadena. After that, I decided I wanted to go back to grad school, and I studied food anthropology at the University of London in England. I lived in England for 3 years and traveled all over Europe, worked for several food nonprofits before returning back to the States in 2013, and continued to teach food classes and food curriculum at the Huntington Library and Botanical Gardens in Pasadena and at several artisan food institutions. To bring me up to where I am today.
Whoa, that's really cool. Okay, so what is the restaurant that you opened with your parents, is it still open?
So we had it for about 5 years, and we sold it. It went on for another 5 years, and it just recently closed.
And what kind of food did you have? What was the cuisine?
So it was a champagne and dessert bar, but we had a full savory menu as well.
God, that's really, that's
it was
really
decadence
cool.
And personified.
Oh, my gosh, no kidding. Well, we're going to be talking about that as well as the show progresses. But as I mentioned, you are involved with the Adult Congenital Heart Association, and I think it would be very important for us to kind of go back in time. I'd like to hear what happened when you were born. Can you take us back to that? What's your story?
Yeah. So I was born a really a pretty sick little baby, and it wasn't until I was about 6 months old when I was diagnosed with a congenital heart defect called Schoen syndrome, which is multiple left-sided heart defects. Congenital heart disease is structural defects that you're born with that are present at birth. I was born in the mid-80s and had to have several open heart surgeries growing up. I've had 4 open heart surgeries, including 2 that were just in the last 4 years. Knock on wood. Hopefully everything's going well now. I'm in good health now, but that's how I got connected and involved with the Adult Congenital Heart Association.
Wow. So you had you had your first surgery. Was that like when you were 6 months old when they diagnosed the Schoen syndrome?
Yeah, so my first surgery, I ended up waiting a little bit. I had, at 11 months old, I had a coarctation of the aorta repaired, and that kind of gave me new life. Even though I wasn't fixed, I still needed to have more surgeries, but I was able to start living a healthy and thriving life at that point. Until I was about age 15, I started to go into heart failure again and needed to have my valves replaced, my aortic valve, and then that magically, again, gave me a new lease on life and is when I started, you know, what I said at the top of the hour, all of the schooling and the traveling and pursued incredible opportunities.
That's really interesting. I'm just curious. So you had that first surgery, then you went many, many years before you had this failure. Were you, because I don't know anybody that's had this, were you a sickly child? Were you able to have, were you restricted as far as what you could do as an adolescent before you had your failure at 15?
Yeah, I was limited. I wasn't, you know, able to run, play sports, do anything that required a lot of physical endurance and stamina. But thanks to, you know, the advances in cardiac surgery and in cardiology in general, I was able to kind of prolong and extend my health as long as possible until I got to adult size and, you know, was large enough to have a valve replacement that would last me, you know, into adulthood.
How long, you know, and you mentioned that you, and you just, did you just recently have a surgery also within the last few years?
Yeah. So the surgery I had when I was 15, the valves that I received were tissue valves, which were really great. It was a really innovative surgery at the time that enabled me to not have to be on blood thinners, which was really good, a good thing as a young woman. But the tissue valves do have kind of a lifetime themselves, which they say is about 10 to 15 years. And my tissue valves lasted 16 years. So when I was 31, I started going into heart failure again and had my aortic and pulmonary valves replaced again at that point. And then because of some other complications that I had, as well as another defect with my mitral valve, I ended up having my fourth surgery about a year and a half afterwards. And at that time, I ended up receiving two mechanical valves because they decided, you know what, these are going to last her the rest of her life. So this will hopefully prevent us from going in every 10 years.
Wow. My goodness. Wow. Did you always that's really remarkable. What are the symptoms that let you know that you were going into heart failure? Could you feel it? Did you know it? I mean, was there something specific that went, "Uh-oh, something's not right?"
It was a real gradual process of decline that was really slow and over time, but I mean, the main symptoms were, you know, getting excessively short of breath and fatigue all the time, even at rest. When I would sleep, if I tried to lay flat to sleep, it would feel like I was drowning because the, you know, blood was backing up into my lungs. So I needed to sleep propped up with pillows. You know, not having great temperature control of my body, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really, isn't it interesting that you got so many years, 16 years, and those 16 years, my gosh, you did a lot of things in those 16 years. Did it frighten you to just pick up and go to London, knowing that you were going to be away from your physicians and all of your health?
You know, I think it scared my parents more than it scared me.
Oh, that's funny.
I have always kind of lived, and I think a lot of people who have any kind of chronic illness live with a kind of gratitude for every opportunity that they have and to want to take advantage of all of those opportunities. And so for me, when I've been ever since 15 being in good health, I really did just kind of seize the moment and wanted to take advantage of every opportunity. And so I was nervous, but, you know, London has some great medical care as well, especially their cardiology team at a couple of the hospitals in London are really, really great. So I wasn't too scared, no.
Well, you certainly have a remarkable attitude. And I hear that, and I hear your gratefulness, and I understand what that must be. Well, I haven't walked in your shoes, but I can certainly appreciate by what you're saying what that must be like for you. And I can appreciate how your parents might have felt as well. And now that you've got these it's just amazing how far we've come in the medical world, right? What was his name? The doctor that did the, wasn't it, they used a pig or something to do those first heart things, or am I thinking about something different? Those were heart transplants, maybe.
They do still use pig valves and cow mm-hmm. tissue valves for some surgeries as well. But some of the original surgeries, were practiced on other animals before they you know, perfected them to be performed on humans. Oh, no. But it is an incredible history, the development of cardiac surgery. It's incredible.
No kidding. And I'm sure that you've met a lot of people along the way that have identified, I'm sure, you just by what you do today. How's your health today? Do you have a really, I would imagine, with these two mechanical valves, I mean, what's the future look like for you?
Yeah, so mechanical valves are supposed to last for your lifetime. So hopefully they will take me well into my old age because I have multiple defects. I do still have one valve, a pulmonary valve, that is going to need to be replaced eventually. But like most of my surgeries that I had in the 80s and 90s, it's kind of been a waiting game, waiting for technology technological advances to catch up to the needs of our body. And so I am hopeful that my next pulmonary valve replacement will be transcatheter, which means that it's not as invasive. They go through an artery in your groin, and it's just a much quicker and easier recovery and is not as traumatic.
Right. Boy, I think about what the experiences that you've been. Have you always just been associated with the same hospital and the same doctor groups through this, or how did that work for you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really interesting because most people with congenital heart disease have just traditionally always gone to pediatric cardiologists, and they stay with their pediatric cardiologists because we have such unique defects and unique health that for continuity of care, we usually stay with the same doctor. But with all the incredible and wonderful advances in medicine, we've now flipped the statistic. It used to be only 10% of people born with CHD would live beyond the age of 18, and we now have 90% of people living beyond the age of 18 and well into adulthood, which has created a really wonderful problem. Do all these adults continue to see pediatric doctors? I saw mine until I was 30 years old. He was like a dad to me. But then eventually I realized, there's this new need, and I need to see a specialist that specializes in adults with congenital heart disease. And so there is now this growing subspecialty across the nation and across the world of adult congenital care. And so I have transitioned onto an adult cardiologist who specializes in congenital heart care.
That's really interesting. We're going to talk a lot about that as well. But before we do, I got to just tell you, you mentioned at the top of the hour about your education, your BA in anthropology from UC Berkeley, and then your MA in food anthropology from the University of London. And, man, that just sounds so cool. But I don't even know, so maybe you can just help me out with this. I don't know what food anthropology means.
Yeah. Well, It is this anthropology in general is the study of man, and cultural anthropology, the study of human culture. So food anthropology is the study of human production and consumption of food throughout history and how it's changed and evolved as we as the species has evolved. And also contemporarily, the social dynamics and like social matrix surrounding food, both production and consumption.
Okay, so give me an example. What does
So
that mean
yeah,
to
so
the
like day
outsider?
one, first class means we look at humans being hunter-gatherers, and then what led to the transition of agriculture and domestication of animals, and how and when did that transition happen, and then with the Industrial Revolution, how our food production changed so rapidly to what we have now, this like industrial food complex where food is, made away from us and not by us, and it's, all this processed food, and now this kind of resurgence of farm to plate and returning
Oh,
to
yes.
the land and the table and all of that, all these food processes.
No kidding. What was the link? Why did you choose to go into that field? Was there some things drawing you to that?
Well, it felt like it was the right thing to pursue because it was two of the things that I loved the most. Food, which I had loved ever since I was a baby, baking with my grandmother up till in college, I started my own little cookie business on the side, to working in restaurants. And then my love of people and understanding kind of the whole social matrix around us that connects us. I really, when I started first working in restaurants, I just loved how food was this like catalyst that brought people together and really facilitated these social relationships. And so those two interests really are what, after working in the hospitality industry, brought me to my graduate study work. Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting that you say this because for people that know anything about me and have followed me and are my personal friends or have become my friends, they know that my husband passed away. It's been almost 11 years, and he loved to cook. And I didn't mind washing the dishes. I didn't really mind that part at all. I just needed to show up and have a delicious meal. But I would 100% agree with you that eating is a form of love, number one. And it does bring people together. And whether you're a vegetarian like my daughter, or you're a vegan like some of my friends, or you just chow down on a steak, the reality is that it is very social. And with the holidays and Thanksgiving and now Hanukkah, the end of the week, and Christmas next Wednesday. And, food is definitely something that binds us, kind of like what you use in cooking when there's a binder. It does bind us, and I can really see that connection. But what I'm curious to know is, how did you go from that industry, which it sounds like you really loved, to the nonprofit health work with the Adult Congenital Heart Association? How did that transition happen for you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a big leap. I started getting involved with food nonprofits at first, and I was going in that direction. I was teaching food classes when I was in London on an inner city urban farm. And then also teaching food classes when I came back to the U.S. So I was really enjoying getting into the nonprofit world and education. And then that was when, in about 2015, so about 4 years ago, when my health started to decline again. And I, like I had said earlier, it was a really slow and gradual decline, and I ended up not being able to, you know, continue being on my feet all day, whether it was in a kitchen or in a classroom. And I had to quit my job, and I had a few years of, you know, when I had the two surgeries kind of basically back-to-back of ill health, where I basically didn't even know if I was going to be able to have a career again or pursue anything. And I, at that time then started, that's when I did some Google searching, and I learned about the Adult Congenital Heart Association as a nonprofit created by and led by patients that support other CHD patients, as well as do advocacy and education and outreach efforts. And so I started getting involved with them as a volunteer, and that's what I first started doing was being part of their peer mentorship program. And I got that same incredible return, you know, the same incredible feeling, reaffirmation and reaffirming feeling of giving food to other people as I did when I was working as a peer mentor and connecting with other patients. And so that's what kind of led me to continue to work and pursue more potential work with the Adult Congenital Heart Association. And they ended up hiring a position, an outreach position here in Southern California.
God, that's the journey that you took makes so much sense to me, because I don't know if everyone that works within the association do you all have a relationship personally with adult congenital heart disease, all of you?
Necessarily. It is a mixture of people with experience in the nonprofit world, as well as patients, family members of patients, medical professionals. We have several nurses on our staff as well. And ACHA, although initially founded by patients, young adult patients themselves, we are also basically a medical association for the subspecialists that I was mentioning earlier as well. And so we have a medical advisory board that is made up of adult congenital heart specialists that help drive our research and our accreditation as well.
I see. So how does it make you feel to be part of this organization?
I feel like it's so affirming, but it's also so so inspiring as well. You know, even though we live in a world of increased technology and connections, I never met another person with a congenital heart disease before the age of 30. You know, living in greater Los Angeles, you know, with a population of 10 million plus, congenital heart disease is the number one birth defect. 1 in 100 babies are born with a congenital heart disease, and I'd never met another person. So to be connected with this organization and to meet other patients, oh my goodness, it was, there aren't words to describe how incredibly affirming it was to not feel so alone. And then to now be on the other side of it, where I now help connect and support other families and patients, as well as help drive the quality of and standard of care that's being given throughout the country. It just it means that our futures for all CHD patients, our futures are going to be brighter.
Oh, I guess. So I think this would be a good point to understand a few more glossary terms for those of us that really don't know. So
sure.
Let's start off with what congenital heart disease is. What specifically does that mean? That you're born with? Well, y'all let you tell me. You're the expert.
No, I'm just by no means an expert. But,
well,
but,
you know.
I'll share what I know. So congenital heart disease, congenital means something that you're born with. So it's a disease or a defect that occurs in utero when you're developing in the womb. Heart, obviously congenital heart, it's of the heart, and it means, while we use the word disease for that D letter, to encompass the whole, the entirety of the spectrum of defects, it is a structural defect is what is congenitally present at birth. And there's about 35 different types of defects, you know, from ranging from a hole in the heart in between the walls of the chamber to the valves, which are like the doors into the heart. Those can be defective, like have two instead of three leaflets, or they can be narrow or just don't open all the way, to some like really complex conditions where people are born with only, you know, one less chamber in their heart and their blood mixes, to there's a heart disease or defect where the heart is backwards in the chest.
Hmm.
So, I mean, there's all different kinds of, I mean, the heart is such a complex organ, and it is the number one birth defect because it is so complex. And so CHD encompasses all 35 defects from simple to complex. And they can be detected at when you're a child, or some people, for the ones that aren't very complex or really simple, sometimes people can go their whole life and not get diagnosed until they're later in adulthood that they have a congenital heart defect.
You know, that's so interesting, because if I understand, I'm taking notes. I must tell you, I am taking notes because I want to learn this. So the first thing I heard you say is that it's the number one birth defect. And I think I also understood you to say there are 35 defects. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, approximately,
okay.
Yes.
About, okay. Because, you know, what went through my mind, I'm a sports person. And I remember, because I live by Loyola Marymount University, and this was many years ago, I'm thinking, I don't know, at least 25 years ago, probably 30 years ago, when a very prominent basketball player at LMU named Hank Gathers just died on the court. I don't know if you even knew that. Did you even know that story?
No, I didn't. No.
It was a really big deal. Big deal in that Loyola Marymount was very prominent in those days, so they had a lot of national exposure. And this man had a healthy, athletic, alive, and gone. And they came to find out that he had birth defects, and nobody knew. I must tell you also, on a very really personal note, but why not? We're talking about hearts. That's what happened to my husband. My husband died. I don't think it was ever considered a birth defect. It might have been a disease. I don't know what. But he did not have a heart attack. He was diagnosed when he just suddenly was alive and dead at the Staples Center. He died of sudden cardiac arrest. And I don't know, I've never really heard if that's something that maybe was always there that nobody knew. But, you know, I mean, that heart needs to be pumping and it needs to be working. And the fact that you guys do what you do to inform and inspire and support is really, it's life-changing. I just think it's phenomenal, and I appreciate you allowing me just to digress a moment and talk about my own personal experience, because things happen in lives, and I want to get back to your organization and the incredible work that you're doing. I might also mention that you have a really great website, and I will make sure that people know about this. If they read my blog, they've certainly seen it, and I will certainly include that in my follow-up blog. But you can simply go to their website, which is the www.ACHA. That stands for Adult Congenital Heart Association, but it's ACHA Heart, H-E-A-R-T, .org. And man, you have a tremendous, tremendous website. I so recommend anybody that's interested in this field that they check this out. So when this is a national organization, am I right about that?
Yes, we are. We are based in Philadelphia, and we've been around for about 22 years now as a nonprofit. We are a small nonprofit. We have a staff of about 18 people, but we have a lot of our staff based around the country, working remotely, including mm-hmm. several of us, like myself, who are regional development leaders working specifically in regional outreach and events. In specific areas, mostly on the western side of the country.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
You are a nonprofit. What is your mission? Do you have a mission statement that people should know about?
Yes. Our mission is to improve and extend the lives of the millions of people who are born with congenital heart disease through education, advocacy, and research. And that research bit is really exciting because just this last year we started our first research program ourselves, where we are directly funding CHD-specific research, as well as we support and sponsor two fellowships to try to encourage people to pursue CHD, ACHD as a subspecialty as doctors, because it does require additional training. And we also have just a few years old and a very exciting national accreditation program where we accreditate hospital programs. And what we're doing with that is really raising the standard of care that adult congenital heart disease patients receive. Because like I said earlier, it really is this new subspecialty, and we're kind of writing the book, you know, creating the guidelines, creating the protocols for what good care is needed and looks like for these patients.
Well, and I think that what's clear is that your focus is on adults. You had mentioned that you were with a pediatric, you know, program until you realized, my gosh, I'm 30 years old, maybe I need to be with adults. So this doesn't so you have maybe youngsters and teenagers and then young adults that perhaps transition into your group. Is that typical that happens?
Yeah, so it's starting to become the standard now. Like I said earlier, a lot of people would stay even beyond their 30s continue with their pediatric cardiologist because they're the ones who know their hearts the best, mm-hmm. in comparison to general cardiologists who focus on acquired heart disease, you know, clogged arteries and things like that. It's very different, and it's difficult for a general cardiologist to treat and take care of a complex congenital heart patient. So, mm-hmm. A lot of patients would stay well into adulthood, but with the field growing exponentially as it is, because thank goodness we're all living so much longer. It's a good problem to have, right? We've realized that, you know, there's a lot more needs that we have as patients that even our pediatric cardiologists might not be able to help us with. Like for me as a mm-hmm. woman, family planning, you know, I need to be able to talk about family planning and birth control and all those kinds of things that accompany adulthood, but in consideration of my heart defect as well. And so that's where these adult congenital heart specialist doctors, they have this comprehensive, holistic view as they treat us into adulthood.
Well, the fact that you had said earlier that 90% make it into adulthood, I mean, it's pretty remarkable where you've come in the field of science and how people are really living long and productive lives. It's really incredible. Tell us a little bit about some of the services. You mentioned the peer-to-peer. What are some of the other services? I mean, if somebody's listening and says, oh, my God, I can't believe I didn't know about this, or I need to talk to my cousin or my sister or whomever that might be benefiting from this, what are some of the services that you do provide?
Yeah, so the peer mentorship program, which used to be called our ambassador program, was kind of our flagship program that is what we started on. And what that does is that connects people from anywhere across the country by phone or email to a trained support person who can talk to them if they have just a one-off question or need maybe a few months of ongoing support as they prepare for or are recovering from a surgery. In addition to that direct one-on-one support, we offer, and you can see on our website, a whole huge range of educational resources, Q&As. We have an incredible webinar series. We do 10 to 12 webinars a year that are given by medical professionals on a variety of topics, from defect-specific to more generalized topics. And all of those webinars are archived on our website, so you can go back many years and re-listen to all of those. Those have been a really invaluable tool and resource for a lot of patients. In addition, we have two other educational resources that are really popular. One is our health passport, and it's like a passport, but instead of having all your travel stamps in it, you have all your key health information pertaining to your heart. There's a space to include your baseline EKG so that as you travel around the world, like when I went to London, and you maybe have an emergency, you go to an ER, most ERs don't know anything about congenital heart disease, or at least maybe not something specific to your condition. And so to have that in your pocket and be able to share that as you travel is like an extra safety net, which is really helpful. We also have a clinic directory, which is another great thing to take with you when you travel. We have listed all of the clinics and doctors, not just across the states, but in other countries as well, that specialize in see patients with congenital heart disease. So wherever you are, you can find someone who is can treat your specialized care.
That is so great. I mean, really. I mean, when you think about where you've come, I wrote it down somewhere. When did this start? It started
1998.
Where's my notes? 1998, from 1998 to where you are today, isn't that dramatic? Of course, our technology has certainly improved. I mean, now we have access to anyone around the world at any given time. But how I don't know. I mean, it makes me clutch my heart. I mean, how wonderful to know that you are not so limited any longer, that you've got this portal, that you've got this link that just can go with you and that can be picked up anywhere. What a tremendous resource that is, truly.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think our overall what we as an organization are focused on is really empowering patients and families to become their own best advocate. And what that involves is being knowledgeable about their condition and what care they need. And so we do that both with all of our educational resources, but then also connecting patients together. We're doing more of that on a regional level as well. We have regional conferences every year, as well as a national conference every 4 years. And then, like I said, stepping up and increasing the standard of care on the medical professional side as well with our national accreditation program and our inaugural research grants. So we're trying to, from a whole lot of different angles, try to build up and support the entire congenital heart disease community.
You know what else you said, Emily, that I thought was, that can't be bypassed, that I think is also really, really important, is you mentioned the word families. When someone has any kind of condition, your parents know this, when it's mm-hmm. your child, it's your brother, it's your whomever, if the family is affected. And it's wonderful to know that maybe there are people that are listening that could say, gosh, you know what? I could use some support. I want to make sure that I'm informed. I'm understanding, because this doesn't just affect my son or my daughter. This affects all of us. And I think mm-hmm. that when families feel empowered, they are then another great resource for that loved one that is also having the issues of whatever is dealing with their health. I don't know if you have to manage special diets, or if you have to manage special exercise or medications. I mean, all that clinical stuff, I'm sure, is all part of having a healthy lifestyle and having your heart work to the best of its ability, right? I would presume that mm-hmm. all of that's part of it.
Absolutely. Well, I think with any chronic illness, you know, people need to and do rely on a real village or community of people to help care for them. And certainly when it's a sick child, obviously there's a huge, it falls primarily on the parents, but also the siblings too. And we obviously work with a lot of the pediatric organizations as well. And I can attest as a patient myself with siblings that it really does impact your whole family, mm-hmm. that the whole journey of a chronic illness, especially as a child. And now as an adult, it impacts my husband too. And I think that was one of the things that scared me the most going through my first surgery as an adult was that I now had to have my husband go through this as well. It's one thing for me to just take on the burden all myself, but then to have another person have it become their worry as well, it's hard, it's difficult. And so we do, as an organization, we do support that as well. We have an online community that is inclusive for families, spouses, and siblings as well.
I think that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Another thought just occurs to me, and since I don't know, I don't know, is congenital heart defects, so it's in vitro, as you said, you're born with it. Mm-hmm. Is there a tie-in to genetics? In other words, do you inherit that, or is it just what it is?
Well, so we're still learning a lot as we're, doing more and more research on the genome and on genetics in general. And it does vary defect to defect, because I'm not a geneticist by any means. I don't understand.
Okay, sure.
It very well. But the short answer is that, yes, there are genetic indicators that CHD is encoded in us genetically. However, that does not mean it's a guaranteed heredity. So you're not mm-hmm. Going to 100% pass it on. I've met so many CHD patients who then go on to have heart-healthy children themselves as well. We're still figuring out a lot about the genetics and origins of it and what causes it. And, they're trying to target exactly where on genes certain defects are linked to. It's still not like 100%,
interesting.
Hereditary.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
While we're talking about your organization, I know that you do some fundraising, and I would really like you to have the opportunity to talk a little bit about that right now. What's coming up for you guys?
Yeah. So like all nonprofits, obviously we do require support, and we fundraise both. We apply to corporate and government grants, but we also have fundraising events, the most prominent of which is we have a walk series. It's called the Walk for One in 100, and we have it across the nation, typically in about 13 to 16 different walk sites over the course of a year. And it's great. It's usually 1 or 2 miles. Some of the sites are a 1K or a 5K, but they're usually walks, and they're really fun, family-friendly events that I highly encourage you to go onto our website and find out more what our upcoming walks are for 2020, which we've just announced. In addition to that, we do a few other fundraising events in Boston, Houston, and Los Angeles. We have a gala each year. And then around the country, we also have other smaller kind of third-party fundraising events, you know, Pizza with a Purpose, Paint with a Purpose, a lot of kind of grassroots organizations that are initiated by our patients and families across the country. And I'll say here in Los Angeles, we the last couple of years, we've had a CHD Awareness Night at Angel Stadium. We partner with a couple of local CHD organizations to put that on. And so we're, you know, my role here in Southern California is relatively new, so we're figuring out, you know, what other kind of future opportunities we might have to rally the community together for CHD.
I think that's great, and as I'm looking at your website, I see that you have a national convention, or national conference, let me use the correct word, a national conference it's your ninth, that's coming up in October of 2020, and, you know, people might say, oh, God, October is so far away. Well, look how fast this year went. We're about to enter a new decade in another couple of weeks. So, you know, it's another thing that people that want to learn more can certainly look at, just like your Walk for 100. I think that's another – your site is really tremendous for people that want to listen and I that want to learn more. I think that it's great. If you wanted to just – if you are standing on a stage, you're doing a TED Talk, and you had an opportunity to – and I don't know, have you ever done one of those? Because
no,
I'm sure
I haven't,
really good at it. But if you were just standing on the stage holding a microphone to an audience of people, what do you think you would just – what would your message be to those families and individuals? What would you say to them?
It's all CHD families and patients. I don't know. That's such a good question. So the audience is CHD patients and families?
Yes.
I'd probably make them all stand up and turn to each other and hug their neighbor and say, look at all these people around you. They are all part of your community. Now let's work together to strengthen our community. Get involved, volunteer, join us in our advocacy legislative days that we have. You know, you're not alone.
Oh, gosh. See, you can do it. You're not alone. I picture yourself. Because you don't know. Someday you may be that TED Talker that does just what we just said. So, I mean, we've got about another 10, 15 minutes, and I think I'd like to talk a little bit about I don't know necessarily how you measure success. I don't know that it's a measurement necessarily. But just professionally and personally, what do you consider some of your greatest successes to this point in your life?
Oh, goodness, that's a good one. I mean, it is interesting because where I've ended up professionally now is so intertwined with my life personally. And so I can say that professionally I'm most proud of just working for this organization, for the Adult Congenital Heart Association, and giving back to the community of congenital heart patients. And I think personally, my greatest successes are all of my relationships with my family and friends, because Like we said earlier, it really takes a village. And the last two surgeries I went through, I just realized how incredibly lucky I am to have the love and support in my life that I have. And I wouldn't have had any of the successes without that support. Yeah.
How long does it take? Your last surgery, we'll just go by that one, where they put the mechanical valves in. How long did it take for you to fully recover from that?
Well, everyone's different. I'll say that as a disclaimer,
especially
as we get older, too. But I can say personally for me, so you're in the hospital for about 5 days. You go home, and they tell you you're on restrictions, sternal precautions, they call it, for 6 weeks. So you can't drive, you know, you can't lift anything over 5 pounds. So you really revert to being very extremely dependent upon other people to do things, make things, you know, and help you get around and stuff. But so technically they say after 6 weeks you can go back to work. But
really?
Boy, I was exhausted, you know, and it was still a roller coaster recovery at that point. I think for me, at about the 3 month mark, I was able to resume part time work. But it wasn't until I got to the year mark, a year post op, where I really felt like I had regained my energy, my stamina, just my myself, my who I thought I was before surgery. You know.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's
so
a long...
it does take a long time. But again, like I said, that was me. And the younger you are, the healthier you are. I was really sick going into my last surgery, so I think that might have been part of it as well. And I had a few complications. So, it varies person to person. But it is a big undertaking, which is why the minimally invasive procedures they're really pioneering now are such a big deal, because if you don't have to crack open someone's sternum and rib cage, it's a much faster recovery process.
I bet it is. I don't even know if we want to bridge the conversation about insurance, so maybe we'll just not. Because that can be probably very, very controversial. So let's leave that on the side.
Well, Marcia, what I will say is
yes.
that we as an organization do provide help to people to navigate insurance to the best that we are able to with our limited resources. And we can put people in touch with social workers and get them the right kind of help they need to figure out and navigate the insurance world.
I almost couldn't not mention it, because I'm sure that there certainly is a component of that. What would you say have been your biggest challenges? As you look back on your 38 years old? Is that how old you are?
35. Yeah, 35.
Oh, let's not get you older than you are. So what would you say have been your biggest challenges?
I think because of the personality I have, I think I've always struggled with knowing what my limits are and pacing myself, not overdoing it, not stressing about the unknowns in life. I think the last surgery especially, I learned for the first time in my life to be at peace with just being, with just sitting, just being,
yes.
and not doing anything and not worrying about anything. And that was a hard thing to come to accept, but I finally did it.
You know, that's so interesting. I have to pursue that, because I feel like I'm going to know your answer, because while I don't even want to begin to say that I can understand physically what you've been through, but I understand my personality and I understand your personality. How did you go about reaching that level of peacefulness? What mechanics did you do that got you to where you are today?
Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, having a broken sternum in your chest helps, because it forces you to sit still a lot more. But
yes.
You know, pursuing things that such as yoga and meditative mindfulness, mm-hmm. you know, really intentional breathing, doing things that bring me a lot of joy that are less, you know, strenuous, like crocheting and reading and working on puzzles, crossword puzzles.
Nice.
You know, you find ways to keep your brain stimulated and active without having to overstrain your body and overtax yourself. And so that helped me because you know, I'm not going to totally put my mind at ease, but I can redirect, you know.
It's really funny because, and you know, we started this show off today a half an hour late because of technical difficulties. And that was just messed up, and it is what it is. That's what my husband would say. But
uh-huh.
I have also learned some of the breathing skills that you've spoke about through yoga and meditation. Mm-hmm. And whenever I speak to anybody that I know has my personality and they're stressed out and they say, I can't do yoga, my knees won't let me, I can't get on the ground. It's like, you know what? You can do yoga sitting in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to learn how to manage your breath. I can't even begin to say, that's what I did. I thought, you know what? This is going to work. I'm going to take some breath. I'm going to calm myself down. And guess what? It worked. And you were on the opposite end going, Marcia, not to worry. This will all work out, which it did. And there is something to be said for calming ourselves down, whatever your challenges in life might be. We don't all have the same challenges. Do you have any regrets? Anything that you said, I wish I would have?
You know, I feel like I don't have many because
right.
I've always kind of lived, again, with the blessing of a chronic illness is you live each year almost like it's your last. You take
mm-hmm.
advantage of opportunities when they present themselves, and I was very fortunate to pursue my passions of food and anthropology and cooking and teaching, and I think maybe my only regret is that I didn't talk to my doctor sooner about the options of having a family, about having children, and because I thought that it was just for so long an absolute no, and the reality
mm-hmm.
is it is a possibility for a lot of CHD patients. There are a lot of CHD women having successful pregnancies, heart healthy children, and so I wish I had just talked about it sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's not too late because my husband and I still talk about the possibility in the future of adopting. And right now we're very blessed to have a lot of nieces and nephews that we
nice.
Get to shower all of our affection on. So
that's nice.
Thank
so
you.
What would you say you are the most grateful for? I feel like I almost know your answer.
I guess I've kind of said it already in so
yes.
many words.
I am
ironically grateful to have had my CHD because it has not only given me a really grateful perspective in general on life, but it has brought me together with my family, and my support system has really strengthened us as well to go through. I mean, any trials you go through with someone, you always come out a little bit stronger, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I'm grateful for my congenital heart disease.
Wow, that's really profound. And I know that I've mentioned earlier that I'm going to just mention your website once again so that people can check it out. So it's www.achaheart, that's all one word, .org. And it really doesn't matter whether you're neighbors like you and I are or you're living, you know, in Minnesota or other parts of this country. The reality is that that you can get this help and you can get this information, whether you are the patient or you are the family member, and people that have younger children right now, how nice for them to know that there is something forward for them. You're a 15-year-old, but now you're looking towards the future and you're thinking, well, what's going to happen when I'm 25 years old? Can I go to college? Do I have to live in fear, or can I live in the moment with important information to help me live a healthy lifestyle, regardless of what that defect was? And you had mentioned that there are 35 of them, so everybody doesn't have the same defect. And the fact that you can know and not feel isolated, which I think is one of the things you mentioned earlier, that living in isolation with whatever a condition is that you might have, where somebody really doesn't look at you. You said you were 30 years old when you met the first person really that understood what it felt like to be you. I mean, that's pretty remarkable in a city as large as Los Angeles when you think about it. It's pretty amazing. So I think it's tremendous. And you are so easy to be around, and you are so generous with yourself and your time. I know the organization must love having you because you love being there. So, of course, they do. So I would really, really recommend that everybody listen. And I guess my last question to you, because I think you do have a productive lifestyle, how do you find that you balance your personal life and your work life? How do you balance that for yourself?
Whew, I mean, that's the challenge we all face constantly, right?
It is. We're jugglers.
Especially with our smartphones, you know, going to bed with us and waking up with us in the morning.
Yep.
You know, I try. The two are really integrated. You know, I'm doing work stuff on the weekend, and I try to balance it by making sure to take time each day to spend some time on myself. And sometimes that might even mean a little, you know, 20-minute nap or something. And I've learned to not feel guilty about that, because in the end, it's what sustains me to keep living as productively as possible. Self-care is so important. So,
you know, I would say that it's right up there with learning how to breathe effectively.
Yes.
I think you know, sometimes we think about self-care, and sometimes we don't intentionally do this, but we think it has to do with women. Oh, we'll go get our nails done, or we'll go get a massage or something like that. But men need it equally as much as women do.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, truly.
Oh, yeah.
I think, you know, especially, you know, in today's generation, generally the husband and the wife are working. That's the only way you can afford practically to live anywhere, certainly in the Los Angeles area. And I don't know that men do a very good job of self-care. They really could learn to do that better. I think we sort of instinctively know as women, but you have to take that time, whether it means for grabbing the camera and going outside, which is something I do, or maybe you just decide to go to a movie together. Good knows, you know, I can't wait to see Cats. It's coming out. My kids are dying to see Star Wars. That's coming out. So there are things that you can do to take good care of yourself, so that your tank isn't empty, so that you can give more. And I so agree with what you said about self-care. It's vital. And this hour has flown by. I've loved every minute of it. I appreciate the time you've taken to spend this time with me. I think that when people say, well, what are your shows about? I said, my shows are about my guests. Sure, I have anecdotal things that my guests talk about that I can relate to my personal life. But my show is about, what can we learn and how can we support each other as we hear each other's stories? And I really do believe, Emily, that you've been able to do that very, very well. And you're going to not maybe even know what you've done that's affected other people by listening to the show today. So thank you so much for your generous time today. I so really appreciate you being with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Marcia. Thank you for allowing me to share my story and share what ACHA does, and for this opportunity to be on your show. It's been a real pleasure.
It has. So, everybody, I'm doing one more show. One more show next week, and then I'm going to actually give myself Monday, December 30th off. It'll be my first day off this entire year, but it's going to be a very important show. It's going to be with two people from Susan G. Komen talking about a major conference that's happening in January, and I wanted to be able to let people know about that because they are streaming it in five languages. Can you believe that? It's pretty remarkable. So I do have a wonderful life being able to experience all of these fabulous guests. So once again, I'm going to thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to take us out with a little bit of music. And have a happy holiday season, Emily. I appreciate your time.
You too. Thanks, Marcia.